sounds like you're invited to go back to our breathing. So that our collective energy of mindfulness and bring us together as an organism, flowing into a river with no more separation. Let the whole sangha breathe as one body, generating peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So why don't we begin? Does anybody have any questions in terms of what we've done already today, the practices we've done, various types of instructions that have been received, various kinds of experiences people have had? Is any questions about the practice that we've done so far today?
Does
spaciousness include hearing airplanes and knowing the stars are up there, knowing the wonderful sense in the air, like that? Was that your experience? Not your experience. Good. The practice of being aware of space, and in a more formal sense called space gazing, can be a very formal kind of practice. But in the sense I think that you're asking, it's it allows us to be aware that all experiences, such as smelling an odor, or hearing a sound, or seeing something, it actually arises within spaciousness of mind. The same way you understand that the airplane is moving through space. And when you are aware of the airplane and you're aware of its space at the same time, you are seeing both aspects. You know, oftentimes in life, we just see the plane, right? We don't see the space. And, you know, we get... It's like we see the small picture but not the big picture, you know. Our planet's in big problems, big trouble, because we don't see the big picture. So it's learning to kind of relax our grasping at a phenomena and just seeing the spacious awareness that it's arising in. Which means you can enjoy things, but you don't grasp at things. You don't try to hold on to anything. The plane is just what? Moving through space, we might say. That's all. other questions about the practices we did today? Everybody understood them clearly and were able to practice them? If you weren't, please don't hesitate to ask a question. Okay, so before we, any questions just about one's practice in general? Anybody dumbfounded? Just stuck in a deep muddle? Stuck in the swamp and don't know how to get out? Anybody like that? So everybody is sailing effortlessly through their life. That's wonderful. I'm happy to hear that. Nobody's stuck in the slightest. Only one man willing to admit it. Thank you, David, for answering for all of us. I said, thank you for answering for all of us. So why do you think we're stuck? Why do you think we get stuck in our life?
It's not that I get stuck, but I realize that being more and more aware creates one of the first problems, but might create a little bit of suffering.
Being more aware creates a little bit of suffering.
That's what I realize.
In what way?
I am aware, let's see, I saw something in my granddaughter. And sort of became aware for the first time that her action or reaction was normal, because since she is not, I created this sort of a behavior, which I never realized. It's not that it's bad or good. But it's something, I'll give an example. I noticed that she will put pictures of herself in Facebook, more than pictures of the nature, I was sort of surprised, because she is not somebody who is only thinking about herself. And when I took my daughter's face, it's just as a skirt. I was just a little bit, I even just told her a little. But then we realized, since she's a baby, what does Nanny do? Nanny, always, always taking pictures. Nanny, always making videos. Nanny, always writing things about her. Then I realized, now I'm 16, I have sort of a responsibility. But I wasn't aware, no problem. I just saw all the good things. A little bit of suffering in a way that I realize that I can do things, and this is one example. I can do things thinking it's the best thing I am doing, and then I realize that no, it's dangerous indeed. So that's why I say suffering is the meaning that. And then that I can't judge. I realize I'm
not judge. Again, you know, there's no need to go into the specifics of, adolescent behavior on Facebook. More people have written about it, more aware of it than myself. But, the blame for goes much deeper than that. I mean, we reify self. We call people names. We tell them. you know, you're so-and-so, and this is your doll, and I'm giving you this present, and this is only for you, and we make a big deal about their birth date. So, you know, the whole process, really, of child-rearing has a lot to do with the reification of individuality, right? But what are we going to do? I mean, there are ways of doing it so it's not so definite or defining in the ways to help the child. But, you know, the bottom line is that is the process that we all go through. Right? And the process of life seems to be that we get more and more enmeshed in selfhood. We get more and more enmeshed in grasping at objects and things. And at a certain point, that constriction feels uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Right? It causes more suffering than pleasure. And at that point, you know, you do different things. Right? You find an addiction, substance, shopping, you know, you find food, you know, you find an addiction to, you know, to prevent you from experiencing that, right? You keep inventing new goals and objectives to keep you thinking you're getting somewhere, right? Or you, you know, do what I guess many of us, while we're here, we look into the causes, right? And so that journey, even though it's different for every generation, right, and individual, that is the journey. And so we might say with our children we could have done more to make them, you know, less selfish, less self-focused, right, could have raised them differently. But, you know, there's no great evidence for children who were raised more in that way. You know, the Buddha, right? Didn't have Facebook, didn't post on Facebook, and yet he turned away from worldly life. So, you know, the idea that somehow, you know, through education or child rearing or something, you know, we can prevent the arisal of you know, selfishness or self-centeredness or narcissism and all that. I mean, to one degree or another, but it's kind of built into the process. It's a journey away, and then, you know, we begin consciously the journey home.
I'm sorry, but can we just be like this? Can't be just also awareness for me? Now it's like this. Doesn't tell me that for me.
Right. Yeah. Well, that is the nature. Yeah. Well, there's impermanence. Yeah. When in Dharma we call it impermanent. Anicca. You know that things are. You know that nothing is solid. Everything is empty. Everything is made of parts. Everything is composite, and therefore everything is subject to change. And you know, we should look at all phenomena in that way and not fix it and think, oh, this is. Because it's this way in this moment, it's always been this way, it'll always be this way. You know, this creates a drama of life. Everybody gets freaked out. Everybody gets upset because something happens in reality, some little personal drama, something with yourself or someone else, and you fixate. And in that moment of fixation, it all seems very solid and permanent and real and self-existent, and therefore there's an incredible amount of emotionality and obsession. And then what happens? It changes. It's gone, and all you can do is hold on to it in your mind by repeating it over and over again, right? Until finally, even we get bored of our stories, right? We get sick of them. Then we give ourselves a little break, and then we start a new one. That's ancient. Ancient. And again, you know, the path of Dharma is a path of understanding that basically self-perpetuating but ultimately dissatisfying way of living, and we seek to find another way. In the midst of thoughts, in the midst of feelings, in the midst of relationships, in the midst of the world as it is, we find another way. Because we realize what? Those of you who are in the intensives, you will understand this. The issue is not phenomena. The issue is not things. It is our misperception of the way things are that causes us to grasp, causes us to manipulate, causes us to hold on. And the more we can practice and the deeper we can practice, the more clarity we can bring into our lives, that process will diminish. But you know all that already, don't you? Can everybody hear me, by the way, or am I speaking too softly? Everybody can hear me, even those way out there, and David way back there. And the, you can hear me?
I got
ears on. Okay. Any other questions? So we're gonna go deep today. Yeah, I know. If anybody wants to leave, you can leave now. I sometimes just revisit things. So this is a book called Classics of Buddhism and Zen, a collection of translations by Thomas Cleary. Doesn't Thomas Cleary have a brother? It can't be that he does it all by himself. This guy Cleary is a one-man translator factory. He just these are books he's already printed, but now they put them out in collections. This is one of 8 volumes of translations. Volume 1 had Zen Lessons, Zen Essence, The 5 Houses Zen, Minding Zen, Instant Zen. These. Right. Volume 2, Teachings of Zen, Zen Readers, Zen Letters, Shobogenzo by Dogen and the Ecstasy of Enlightenment. Volume 3 had the Sutra of Wei Ning, Dream Conversations, Kensho, The Heart of Zen, Rational Zen, Zen and the Art of Insight. I mean, it just goes on and on. Plus, he has translated the Avatamsaka Sutra. Has anybody ever looked at the Avatamsaka Sutra? The Huayan Sutra in Mahayana is considered the most profound. I mean, it's like 800 or 1,000. It's incredible. And like small print, and beside the profundity of it, as a work of literature, it is incredible, the Avatamsaka Sutra. I mean, and he translates it. A brave man. So this is just a collection. This is in the Zen Letters collection. Let me see who wrote the Zen Letters. These are the letters of, forgive me for not being more prepared, I just picked out the letters. I was looking through all these letters, and I realized you may want to know who wrote the letters, or maybe not. They're teachings of Yuan Wu. He's best known as the author of the most famous Zen book, The Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of what are called in Japanese koans, these meditation cases with prose and verse. Doesn't really say much about him at all. So it doesn't even say when he lived. Anyhow, he's obviously a great spokesman of the Chinese Chan tradition, Zen tradition. Let me just read just a couple. He says here, China in Yuan Wu's time was dotted with great urban centers that were the focal points of administration, commerce, and high culture. A network of officially recognized Buddhist institutions existed throughout the country. The ancient political philosophy of Confucianism had been revived and reworked under Buddhist influences. Taoism, too, was taking on new forms strikingly parallel to Zen. Chinese art and literature in the Song Dynasty reached an unprecedented level of clarity and elegance. But there were severe problems as well. Sporadic peasant uprisings broke out to challenge the growing inequality of wealth. A reform-minded faction in the imperial bureaucracy aroused the bitter opposition of the bulk of the landlord elite and went down to defeat. So, adequate to the task of keeping the peasantry in check, the bloated military establishment was about to go down to crushing defeat at the hands of a relative handful of barbarian invaders. Whatever its glories, the world of the Song Dynasty was anything but the serene homeland of the wisdom of the East that some Westerners like to imagine. And he says, given the historical, vast historical distance that separates us today from that time of China, it is all the more remarkable how his letters communicate with us about the universal issues of the life of wisdom. And then he goes on to say, maybe we mistakenly overestimate the differences between ourselves and the people of other times and places. The differences in the technological environments are obvious, but then as now, people were caught up in their conditioning, driven on by their hopes and fears, eager to live up to socially defined goals and pursue images of the good life. Aren't the perceptions of most of us today still structured in terms of self and other, gain and loss, love and hate, desire and aversion? Don't we automatically assume that these dualities reflect an objective reality that leaves us no choice in the matter? Pretty good. So this is a letter, and again, it doesn't say who the letter was written to. But I don't know if this is the translator, gives it a title, but it's called Make Enlightenment Your Standard. And we'll see how far we can get in the letter. He begins, fundamentally, this great light, and again, I think I've read when I've read letters before, please understand, this is the day before Facebook. Before internet, before email, before video, Skype, and before telephones, et cetera, et cetera. People lived a long distance from each other. And so oftentimes you might have a teacher that you might have encountered. He might have been visiting in your temple, and you might have connection, or you might have gone at a great distance to meet the teacher and spend time with him. But you do not see your teacher that often. So oftentimes the communication was simply between letters. And obviously in those days it wasn't, you know, next day delivery. So what you find in a lot of these collections of letters of the masters is that they're fairly involved and quite profound. Because obviously, and again, you know, they weren't DVDs or, CDs of teachers' talks that people can access. So in a way, he was probably responding to a letter, but really taking the time, as you can see, to really give a very profound teaching to whatever student of his wrote the letter. So he begins, fundamentally, this great light is there with each and every person right where they stand, empty, clear through, spiritually aware, all pervasive. It is called the scenery of the fundamental ground. Boom. Right? Boom. He doesn't mince words. I mean, this is the directness of Zen. Just puts it right out. Right? Cuts through all the nonsense. Right? This great light, this great Buddha mind, whatever you want to call it. That is in each and every person, which means who? It means you and me, right? Is right here, is right where they stand. Right where they stand, or since we're sitting, right where we sit, right? It is empty, clear through, spiritually aware, all pervasive. It is called the scenery of the fundamental ground, which means what? It is active right this moment in each of us. What is it that hears? What is it that sees? What is it that's thinking right now? It is this. He calls it the great light. Skip's translator calls it the great light. Buddha mind, true mind, no mind, unconditioned mind, whatever you want to call it. It is what we are perceiving with right this moment. Right? That which is listening to this talk, that which is talking, is no different than this Buddha mind. Right? And rather than point in all different directions and run people about, he just points right to it. Sentient beings and Buddhas are both inherently equipped with it. And again, what's the difference between a sentient being and a Buddha? A Buddha knows it. A sentient being doesn't. A Buddha has awakened to this, as he says, empty, clear, through, spirituware, all-pervasive mind. That's what makes a Buddha. It's not that he gets big ears. It's not that he gets webbed fingers and toes. It's the awakening of his mind, or mind, that makes one a Buddha. Buddha means an awakened one. Sentient beings and Buddhas are both inherently equipped with it. It is perfectly fluid and boundless, fusing everything within it. It is within your own heart and the basis of your physical body and of the five clusters of form, sensation, conception, motivational synthesis, and consciousness. Those are the five skandhas. It has never been defiled or stained, and its fundamental nature is still and silent. Shall I read that again? Again, he's talking about our true mind. Perfectly fluid and boundless, fusing everything within it. Now, notice. Notice something. You know that prior moment? How do we get from that prior moment to this moment? Were there any bumps? No. It was fluid. There wasn't a gap, was there? Look, right now, was there a gap between the last moment? Right. And it's perfectly adaptable. It can be present here. You can see that little animal. Right. It just flows from experience to experience without a gap, without a jolt. Right? It can be here talking Dharma. It can be out there munching on fruit, right? And it doesn't miss a beat, does it? It just flows fluidly. It can get happy, it can get sad, right? It can be calm, it can be angry. And then it just continues on to something else. It is fluid. Right? And yet, as he says, it is never defiled or stained. Right? Its fundamental nature is still and silent. Like the mirror, right? That wonderful example of the mirror. The mirror reflects whatever appears before it, right? But whatever appears before it does not leave a trace on that mirror, does it? Right? Does not leave a trace on that mirror. Something beautiful can be fearful, something ugly can, right? And yet that mirror is unstained by that experience. It continues to have that capacity to perfectly reflect whatever appears in it. Like our own minds, our true minds. Right? That is why one is capable of being sad or happy. Right? That is why one is capable of having high thoughts and low thoughts. Selfish thoughts and altruistic thoughts. This one mind can contain everything. That is why it said, you know, it is beyond good and evil, good and bad. It is beyond high and low. It is beyond ignorance and wisdom. Is that clear? I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, this is the fundamental, you know, it's like, In the Zen tradition and the Dzogchen, you know, in these meditative traditions, in these traditions of enlightenment within Buddhism and direct realization, this is the fundamental truth. Right? This is not where you see, this is the difference between the Zen school and other schools. In other schools, we are here, right? Ignorant beings are here. Enlightenment is something way out here, you know. And enlightenment is something we work toward, right? Ba-bum, 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 and eventually you get to. In Zen, it's right in the beginning. It says you're right here now. Just wake up. Now, of course, all the practices help us wake up. So it's not just a matter of saying, "Oh, wake up!" Or I'm, you know. But you see what he does. It's very wonderful. It's like he shows you the top of the mountain first. He shows you the view from the top of the mountain. But he also says, you only think you're at the foot, looking up. You're actually there right now. Patience. We've only heard his first paragraph. Patience. He may answer your question. He's not a dummy. He may know there are people like you out there with their questions. Are you willing to wait a few minutes? let us see if the master anticipated Ruth Epsteiner in 2011. It has never been defiled or stained, and its fundamental nature is still and silent. Then he says, false thoughts suddenly arise and cover it over and block it off and confine it within the six sense faculties and the sense objects. Is this what kind of way you're beginning to ask? All right, so we might wonder, well, how come I don't know it? I mean, the obvious question, how come I don't know it? And now he's telling you, okay? False thoughts arise. Thoughts arise. Right? They arise suddenly, right? And it covers it over. It blocks it off. It confines it within the six sense faculties and the sense objects. Right? Sense faculties and sense objects are paired off, and you get stuck and begin clinging and get attached. You grasp at all the various objects and scenes, produce all sorts of false thoughts, and sink down into the toils of birth and death, unable to gain liberation. Is that clear enough? Okay. So in a nutshell, he's giving us, you know, books and books of Buddhist psychology of how, you know, how did people say, well, how did I get here? Well, this is how you get there. Thoughts. Senses, sense objects, they come together and they, you know, they become pairs, duality. And there's grasping and there's clinging and there's attachment and there's aversion. Right? And before you know it, what? Drama. Everybody know drama? Drama. Minute to minute, hour to hour, day by day, lifetime to lifetime, drama. Not dharma, drama. We grasp at all the various objects and scenes, produce all kinds of false thoughts, and sink down into the toil of birth and death, unable to gain liberation. Is that clear? That's how we get here. We see, we hear, we smell, we taste, right? We have senses that grasp onto, then we create something solid, we create thoughts, perceptions, the whole thing, and then it solidifies, it fixates. And this whole self-created drama of a self, of another, of permanence, of solidity, of gain and loss, right? Success and failure, like and dislike, you know, the eight worldly dharmas. All get created, and we just are wrapped up in it, right? And because we are so wrapped up in it, we don't what? We don't see the sky. Right? Anybody have that experience? You're so wrapped up in your drama, you're so wrapped up in emotion, you don't notice what? It's a beautiful day. Right? Did it ever happen to anybody? You don't notice it's a beautiful day. The sun is shining. Flowers are out. We get so wrapped up in our problems, we forget all the things to be grateful for. Anybody even notice that? Right? We get so caught up in our drama, in the drama of self, the drama of gain and loss, success and failure, hope and fear, right? That we forget. We don't notice the way things really are. So that's what he's saying. Is that okay? Can we accept that, or you want to argue with him? That's the beginning of wisdom right there. Next paragraph. All the Buddhas and ancestral teachers awakened to this true source and penetrated clear through to the fundamental basis. All the Buddhas, all the ancestral teachers, right, in their practice, whatever discipline they were following, all, whatever tradition of Buddhism, whatever meditative tradition or whatever, doesn't matter. All of them have to, at some point, come through, cut through all the duality, cut through all the attachments, cut through this fog of conceptualization, right, that covers the mind, and have to penetrate to the source. Our true mind. That is that experience of awakening to reality is what's common to all the Buddhist traditions, whether you're Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and all the 50,000 lineages and traditions that are found within them. All of them, when they get to the source, arrive at the same place. Is that clear? And that's what he's saying. Then they took pity on all the sentient beings sunk in the cycle of birth and death, and inspired by great compassion, they appear in the world for this reason. So he says, why do these Buddhas and great masters, why do they do what they do? Because of their great compassion, right? Because having seen clearly that each sentient being has within them this this jewel, right? This treasure, right? And seeing sentient beings wandering around, lost in drama, that they don't even know is self-created, right? Because the Buddhas and the Masters have awakened from it and see so clearly the illusory nature of people suffering, right? They what? They teach. They stay in the world and teach. Inspired by their great compassion, they see sentient beings sunk in the cycle of birth and death. Sunken, it doesn't mean that we all aren't born in the historical realm, we all not born or die, but we're what? Sunk. You know, there's a difference between swimming and sinking. Right? So they're saying they see sentient beings are sunk. The boat is sunk. When the boat is sunk, what? It's not moving. It's not floating gaily on the surface. And that's the way the masters see us. We're sunk. Sunk into the drama of our lives. Sunk into the ups and downs, the gains and losses, the acquisition, the needs, the wants, the hurts, the fears, right? On and on and on. This whole drama just created within our own thoughts. None of it real in any intrinsic way. They see that, right? And they have compassion. If they have compassion, what? I don't know, they'd be watching TV all day or something. I don't know what they'd be up to. Just enjoying themselves. But they see us mucking about. One is forever stamped with enlightenment, your inner heart is independent and transcendent and brimming over with life. As soon as you rouse your conditioned mind and set errant thoughts moving, then you have obscured this fundamental clarity. Okay. So when we keep this endless process of conditioned way of thinking going endlessly, endlessly, falling around, this fundamental clarity. And again, maybe there are many people here who in retreat or in their meditation or today or something, even for a moment, touch this clarity. And all of a sudden, the drama disappears. Right? The thoughts stop. Or there's enough space between them. Right? And that one sees and experiences, as he says, that your own inner heart is independent and transcendent and brimming over with life. Right? Some people think, oh, you know, you follow a spiritual path, a meditative path, it takes you away from life. And he says, no, it brings you into the center of life, true life. So he says, if you want to pass through easily and directly right now, is there anybody who would like to right now pass through easily and directly into the source? Okay. So listen carefully. So he says, if you want to pass through easily and directly right now, just let your body and mind become thoroughly empty. So it is vacant and silent, yet aware and luminous. Just let your body and mind become thoroughly empty. What does he mean, empty? Empty of thought. Empty of conceptualization. Empty of judgment. Right? That's what he means when he says empty. It's not like you've got to take everything out. You know, here's my gallbladder. You know, you don't get it's not like that. You've got to empty it all out. Empty it of all its thoughts, all its conceptions. This is this, and this is that, and I like this, and, you know, and all that stuff. You're this and I'm that. Empty. So it is vacant and silent and yet aware and luminous. You know, these are the qualities of our mind, right? Right? Like right now, all of us are aware. You're aware of something. You're aware of my words, you're aware of that guy walking around out there, you're aware of how your knees feel. You know, right now, all of us participate in awareness. The luminosity of this awareness is that it lights up everything it touches. And yet, rather than resting in the luminosity of our awareness, we get what? Caught up in drama. We grab, right? We leave the luminosity. We leave the clarity. So he says, just let your body and mind become thoroughly empty so it is vacant and silent yet aware and luminous. Inwardly, forget all your conceptions of self and outwardly cut off sensory defilements. Okay, so now he's a little more, telling you more how to do it. Inwardly, forget all your conceptions of self. Right? You know, that's anything you attach the word me, my, I. Right? That conception, that thought, that relates phenomena to something called a me, that makes me the owner of something, the possessor of something. Right? He says, forget them all. And outwardly cut off all sensory defilements. Cutting off all sensory defilements means what? We have our senses. We smell, we see, we hear, we taste. The defilements is what? The grasping that is brought on by objectifying what we see. And wanting, grasping, avoiding, averting, liking, disliking. Right? That's how we defile what is just a natural, spontaneous arising of sense consciousness. Right? All that picking and choosing, all that liking and disliking, all that wanting and not wanting, all that good and bad. Right? That's how we defile our senses, because our senses are just natural. Right? So he says, inwardly forget about attaching self to everything, and outwardly just let senses and sense objects just arise naturally, without conceptualizing and without grasping. When inside and outside are clear all the way through, there is just one true reality. It's a two-way mirror. Reflects everything equally. Usually we create inside and outside, don't we? Something's inside me, something outside of me. But if you think about it, funny way of talking, we just make that up, don't we? If you look at it from the point of view of just pure awareness, one is thoughts appear in awareness, feelings appear in awareness, objects of sight appear in awareness, objects of smell, right? Everything is appearing where? In our awareness. Right? And to make an artificial division that somehow that which I'm aware that I perceive is inside the skin is different than something I'm aware of outside creates duality and separation. But the truth is, I can just as easily be aware of how my stomach feels as I can be aware of that car over there, can't I? As I can be aware of you. I mean, I'm adding the word I, let's just say awareness. Awareness embraces everything. It doesn't distinguish between inside and outside. Again, for ordinary purposes, we have to, so when we go to the doctor, we tell them, what hurts, right? But in truth, our awareness is capable of going, of it doesn't stop with inside outside. That's just an arbitrary distinction, isn't it? That's like saying, my awareness, inside is only on your lander's property. Right? I mean, we could say that. Right? But when I look, I can see far. Right? My capacity to see is not bounded by a limitation of your lander's property, is it? You want that kind of freedom. Most people are stuck. Inside, outside. My thoughts, as if there's something special about it. Right? Those are my thoughts. People have things called my past. And they cling to that. Like that's something special. They're just what? Things that are appearing in awareness. That's all. sometimes we can't even know whether, did I actually do this? Or did I just see it in the movie once? Or did somebody tell me about that they did it, and it's been so far, and now I think that I did it. We're not even sure if our, you know, the older we get, we're not even sure if our stories are even correct anymore. Right? Why is that? Because there's no validity to any of it. It's just stories, memories, pictures, images. Right? When inside and outside are clear all the way through, there is just one true reality, which is the reality of our true mind, our Buddha mind, awareness, whatever you want to call it. Then eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and conceptual mind, form, smell, sound, flavor, touch, and conceptualized phenomena, all these are established based on that one reality. This one reality stands free of and just transcends all the myriad entangling phenomena. The myriad phenomena have never had any fixed characteristics. They are all transformations based on this light. Sounds wonderful. You know, in the great verses on the faith mind, you know, that poem that we chant in our chanting service by the third Zen patriarch. You know, there's a line, a verse in there that says, do not reject the sense domain. The sense domain itself is enlightenment. This is what he's talking about. Then eyes, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, form, sound, smell, flavor, touch, and all conceptualized phenomena, all are based on that one reality. We don't have to reject sensory experience if we see it clearly, and so it doesn't become a trap. A trap is something that snares us, right? It becomes a sensory experience becomes a trap when we grasp at it, when we try to hold on to it, when we try to make something of it. But just as an experience of seeing or hearing or smelling or touching or tasting or feeling or thinking, things just arise and pass away. How are thoughts? What is the nature of thoughts? Now, you're all meditators here. Anybody watch their thoughts? How are thoughts? They come and go. Are they permanent? Solid? No. Be imbued with any self-existence or permanent essence or anything? No. They just come and go. Endlessly coming and going. That is their nature. And yet what? We grasp at them as if they're something solid. I like this. I don't like this. That's a pretty cushion. That's an ugly cushion. Right?
What? The thought that says it's pretty or it's not good.
Well, look, Michelle, look at that. Is that telling you whether it's pretty or ugly?
It's a question.
Well, it's not even telling you that.
No, but if I smell something, it tells me that it feels bad, really bad.
According to who? According to who?
My nose.
Right, my. But the cushion is just a cushion.
Yes, with this it's easy.
Right, so all the liking and disliking is in Michelle.
That is a little bit hard.
Why? Where else is it arising? Liking, disliking, what is liking, disliking arise? No, it isn't. Just look. Look at phenomena. Look at this. Look at this. Is this a pretty table or an ugly table? According to who? All right, according to you. Over here she thinks it's the ugliest table she ever saw. Now this table, look at it just as itself. Is there any prettiness or ugliness coming from the table? No, it's all made up. And yet we think they're real, these thoughts we have about reality. Pretty, ugly, good, bad, right, wrong. It's not difficult. It's easy, but we have to let go. This is what he's saying. You know, we are so used to talking this way and seeing things this way. Right, you're right, in that sense. But when you look the way he's instructing us to look, you see, there's nothing here. Right? I mean, that is just that. Right? To call it, I mean, that doesn't call itself a pine tree, does it? No. I don't know if I even call it a pine tree. But, yeah, it's a pine tree. No, it's not a pine tree. Yes, it is a pine tree. No, it's not a pine tree. What if I called it a... Look at it. What if I called it a mahogany tree? What if I called it a teak tree? What if I called it an orange tree? Would it still be what it is? Whatever I call it? It doesn't change, does it? Just the way I'm thinking about it, the way I'm labeling it, that's what's changing. It stays the same. It has no name, does it? We don't, you know, we don't even have a name. Our parents gave us a name. We don't have a name. We're nameless. Right? Michelle, you don't have a name.
My difficulty is communication. How can you communicate if nothing... Because I know it's this. Hello? I could have told you where I played that. No, I just know. What can I talk about?
Who says you can? Yeah, if you were alone, you could be silent. You're absolutely right. Right. Communication only comes because you run into another person. Right? And then don't forget, at one time we just grunted at each other. The good old days. Well, then we just... Right? And slowly we that's all. It's, you know, social relations, you know, that's all, communication. But again, to use words wisely is to understand that they're just words. And the fingers pointing at the moon, they're not the moon. Okay? So we can use words, but hopefully, you know, we'll use words that have a meaning and are accurate somewhat to reality. Yeah, have some intelligence to them. I mean... So you don't have to be silent. You could choose to be silent, but if you use words, we should learn to use wise words, not use words to enslave ourselves, not use words to just increase our suffering, not use words to harm and hurt other beings to create their suffering. Okay? You understand? I know you do.
I understand. I just want to say, understand. If I say this is nice and the other says it's ugly, it's okay. Yes.
Because there's no truth in either one of them.
Exactly.
Right. So now this is very interesting because this is a little unique to Zen and maybe a little problematic. But this is traditional Zen teachings. And it says, you must awaken to this mind first and afterward cultivate all forms of good. So this is very traditional Zen. Going way back, you know. First you have this awakening experience so you know reality, and then after that you kind of cultivate, traditional virtuous practices. Often in Zen training, even for young monks, they'd be put into the meditation hall. Right? Great stress on having at least some even small experience of one's true mind. So one has at least a sense of what who and what one truly is. And then afterwards you begin more traditional cultivation. So he says, you must awaken to this mind first and afterward cultivate all forms of good. Haven't you heard this story? And this is a famous story. I think I've talked from this one. The renowned poet Bo Ju-yi asked the Bird's Nest Monk, what is the way? The Bird's Nest Monk said, don't do any evil, do all forms of good. But he said, even a 3-year-old could say this. The Bird's Nest Monk said, So a three-year-old might be able to say it, an 80-year-old may not be able to carry it out. So it's a very famous story. It's usually in Zen, it's interesting, they talked about it by a poet. I mean, oftentimes the way I've always heard it in Zen is it's some emperor or some high figure who comes to see the bird's nest monk. The bird's nest monk is the one who, he lives in a tree. You know, you often hear about hermits living in caves or living in you know, small little shacks or cabins, you know, way out in the woods or the jungle or the forest. This guy lived up in a tree. He felt it was a good place to practice, obvious for obvious reasons. Beside being away from things, you know, one can't fall asleep on the job. Or it could be. So it induces a certain kind of continual mindfulness living up in a tree. So anyhow, so this is the famous, whether it's with this poet or in the traditional way with this king or general or whatever, he's quite annoyed that he's come all the way to here to meet this famous hermit, and all he gets is this little catch Buddhist phrase about, you know, do good, avoid evil, and often it's said, and work to help all beings. And he gets quite mad at the monk, going, you know, why are you giving me this dribble? I mean, every little, you know, six-year-old in China knows this. And he gives him the wonderful response. Yeah, I mean, you know, any six-year-old can repeat this, but it's difficult even for an 80-year-old to practice. So now he's talking about this aspect of practice. Thus, he said, we must search out our faults and cultivate practice. This is like the eyes and the feet depending on each other. If you are able to refrain from doing any evil, which means, you know, unskillfulness, and refine your practice of the many forms of good, even if you only uphold the elementary forms of discipline and virtue, you'll be able to avoid sinking down to the levels of animal, hungry ghosts, and hell beings. So this is traditional Buddhist teaching about the six realms. And that is really often by the store of one's virtuous actions that one does not fall into lower realms. And again, I think this is understandable without believing in reincarnation or believing in six realms, just within our human life. We know that if we engage in actions, in thoughts, in a lifestyle, that is based on the cultivating of only good to myself and only harm to others. And I am capable of lying, cheating, hurting, harming, et cetera, et cetera. In a certain way, I am creating what? A hellish existence. Or an animalistic kind of existence. Or a ghostly kind of existence. You know, drug addicts, when you see them in their lives, they're kind of ghostly. There's no substance there. Their life is only the substance, the high. So one can understand that, you know, cultivating a virtuous life, avoiding a type of life in which one's constantly involved in unvirtuous and unskillful actions, can certainly prevent one from experiencing a lot of the more painful aspects of human life. So he says, so if one practices the virtue, one can prevent oneself from falling into these darker paths of life. But how much more so, he said, if you first awaken to the instructible essence of the wondrous, illuminating true mind, and after that, cultivate practice to the best of your ability and carry out the forms of virtuous conduct. So he's making a strong pitch for what? For both and, right? You know, good to have to practice good. Good to avoid evil. Good to pay attention to the law of karma, the law of cause and effect. But better yet, to realize the source of things, to realize your own indestructible pure nature. It'll make it much easier to to practice. Because as he says next, you must realize that the causal basis of hell and heaven is formed by your own inherent mind. Right? Right? What causes us? What is the motivating force that leads us in painful paths in this life? Our own minds. And so if you can understand the true nature of your mind, right? Your capacity. See, this is the Zen thing. This is why they say how, understanding, vipassana, deep looking, is so important to understand the nature of the mind. Because it is in the mind that the motivation and the impetus to act in harmful, unskillful ways arises. So when you put together the motivation to do good and to avoid evil, and you combine that with insight into the nature of one's own mind, that is considered, you kind of got it covered in terms of spiritual life. And then he goes on to say, you must keep this mind balanced and equanimous, without deluded ideas of self and others, without arbitrary loves and hates, without grasping and rejecting, without notions of gain and loss. I will read that again. These are his instructions to us. So you're listening, Andy. Good. You must keep this mind balanced and equanimous, without deluded ideas of self and others, without arbitrary loves and hates, grasping, rejecting, notions of gain and loss. Now, pay close attention. Go on gradually nurturing this for a long time, perhaps 20 or 30 years. We don't like that. There are people in this room who are frustrated. They've been practicing, not 20, 2 or 3 years. Right? And they have not reached this point. Right? What does he say? So you have to have this kind of consistency and dedication. Go on nurturing this for a long time, 20, 30 years, whether you encounter favorable or adverse conditions. Do not retreat or regress. Then when you come to the juncture between life and death, you will naturally be set free and not be afraid. Interesting. He quotes must have been a saying. It says, truth requires sudden awakening, but the phenomenal level calls for gradual cultivation. Again, he's bringing the two together. You know, that one can have insight in a flash, but the real cultivation in terms of how to work with the world of phenomena is gradual. And again, combining the two is best. And then he goes, I often see those who are trying to study Buddhism just use their worldly intelligence to sift through the verbal teachings of the Buddhas and ancestral teachers, trying to pick out especially wondrous sayings to use as conversation pieces to display their ability and understanding. This is not the correct view of the matter. Right? So he's saying, don't study Buddhism with your worldly intelligence. All you're gaining is some kind of verbal ability to quote the masters and, a seemingly intelligent conversation about Buddha Dharma. This is not the correct view, he says. You must abandon your worldly mentality and sit quietly with a silent mind. Sorry. Yeah, this seems like a lot more fun and easier, doesn't it? Right, to read Buddhist texts, and have scintillating conversations, book clubs. Right? We like that. Dharma practice is just one big book club. Again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but that is not the true practice. That may be enjoyable, that may be helpful in certain ways, but that will not lead you to awakening, not lead us to awakening. This is not the correct view of the matter. You must abandon your worldly mentality and sit quietly with silent mind. Forget entangling causes and investigate with your whole being. Those of you who are in the intensive know the word investigation. We're actually following a text called The Wheel of Analytical Investigation. Forget entangling causes and investigate with your whole being. When you are thoroughly clear, then whatever you bring forth from your own inexhaustible treasury of priceless jewels is sure to be genuine and real. Any of this not clear? I mean, this is a marvelous, I think, teaching. Very direct, very clear, very simple. I mean, I think he's not doing too many add-ons. Again, this statement about when you're thoroughly clear, then whatever you bring forth from your own inexhaustible treasury of priceless jewels is sure to be genuine and real. When we share the words of others, even the Buddha's words, they're not our own. They're not real. They're not genuine. Words become real and genuine when we have found their meaning through their own experience. Right? That is why the famous sixth patriarch of Zen, Wei Nang, who was illiterate, the son of he sold charcoal. Right? But he had a profound understanding of Dharma. Profound awakening. Why? Because it was his own experience. And he was able, as you know, for those of you who read the Platform Sutra, knows that he was able to write an enlightenment poem that bested the known disciple of the fifth patriarch, who was a great philosophical master of the Buddha's teaching. He was able to write a much deeper insight poem. And he received the bowl and the staff from the fifth patriarch, because his experience was genuine and real. So, he says at the last paragraph, so first you must awaken to the fundamental, capital F, and clearly see the true essence where mind equals Buddha. Detach from all false entanglements and become free and clean. That's nice. Free and clean. Almost like a advertising jingle. Isn't it kind of nice? You're in marketing. What do you think? Detach from all false entanglements and become free and clean. Yeah, no, that's it. A great line. Maybe we could make that or put that up on some kind of thing in the meditation hall. Detach from all false entanglements, become free and clean. Yeah. Actually, you know, when you go to Asian monasteries and monasteries, oftentimes you'll see calligraphy, and a lot of times that's what they'll have. They'll have kind of things like this in the meditation hall, when you come in or on the wall. Detach from all false entanglements, become free and clean. After that, respectfully practice all forms of good and arouse great compassion to bring benefits to all sentient beings. In all that you do, be even and balanced and attuned to the inherent equality of all things. Be selfless and have no attachments. When wondrous wisdom manifests itself and you penetrate through to the basic essence, all your deeds will be wonder-working. Thus it is said, quote unquote, just manage to accept the truth. You won't be deceived. And his final line to who his student was, make enlightenment your standard. And don't feel bad if it is slow in coming. Take care. And he ends the letter. Make enlightenment your standard. And don't feel bad if it's slow in coming. Take care. So again, you know that in the Zen tradition, in the Mahayana tradition, in the Bodhisattva tradition, one makes the vow what? To attain enlightenment. That is the basic vow. May I attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's called the Bodhisattva vow. Right? And anybody can make it. Right? Which means all of us can make it. And traditionally all Mahayanists make this vow. And this is what he's talking about. When he says, make enlightenment your standard, even if it's slow in coming. In other words, set your sight to the best of your ability, even though it may be up and down, easy, hard, right? Flowing or frustrating. Right? But he says, you know, make enlightenment your standard. That's the standard, that's the criteria by which you are practicing. And also maybe, you know, is also standard, isn't it like a flag or something, we say, standard, you know, kind of the flag we carry. So he says, make enlightenment your standard, and don't feel bad if it's slow in coming.
I'm sorry, but can I just always to myself say, but never, never, never judge, don't.
You want to say that?
Yes, because I think not to forget.
Oh.
Not to forget, because sometimes I'm thinking about the duality, good and bad. They say good.
No, no, you used to, Michelle. But after you heard this teaching today, you're never again going to do it. because you want to live in equanimity and harmony, and you don't want to be judging. That's grasping at phenomena, that's making up stories. Good, you're right. All you need to do is take care of one, make enlightenment the standard for who? For Michelle.
And I'm Buddha and I cannot.
Well, that's, you're going to have to decide what you are. Okay? Yeah, that's good. Yeah, we don't. Yeah. Yes. I'm confused. What is the it?
That's it. Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know what that is.
Oh. Can you see me? Are you seeing?
Yes.
Are you hearing?
Yes.
Are you feeling? That's what? What is that? And what are its qualities of that? Is it all flowing, all embracing? Luminous, which means It lights up everything. Everything is seen clearly. Oh, it's... When you have a light, right? When you turn on a light in a room, you see everything clearly, don't you? The light lights everything up, doesn't it? In the light, everything is seen clearly. In this true mind, you don't have to... I think what's so hard, because with our thinking mind, our conventional mind, we always have to be doing it. So we think that that somehow to understand or to have wisdom or to see clearly is something, is a conceptual shift. But that's not what's being said here. That's not what any teacher, that's not what the Buddha said. He said, when I awaken to my true mind, I also awaken to my own inherent, that this mind has its own inherent knowing, its own inherent wisdom, its own capacity to see things clearly just as things are. You don't have to do it. You have to get out of the way. And what do you think the basis of our dualistic thinking? How do you think we even know anything? What is the basis of that? I mean, right now we are talking. And even though they're what we are saying and the words we are speaking to each other may be understood or not, there is some kind of communication going on between us right now. Isn't there? Right? You know, we don't want to... We get too caught up in words. Right? The capacity to know the nature of reality is right here. But we need to clear out so we can just see. And then it all becomes very simple. But you can't think it. We always think there's something we have to do. In Zen and in Dzogchen, they both say the same thing. We have to stop doing. That's why there's such an emphasis on relaxing the mind. Relax the mind. That doesn't mean go to sleep. That doesn't mean daydream, but it means relax it so it's not fixated, it's not rigid, it's not holding on to anything. Let it just open. So this... What? You'll have to ask the animal. There's only one thing that each of us has to think about. I have to think about, why is Fred not enlightened? I don't need to think about animals. The animals are doing fine by themselves. Just think about Fred. You think about B. Why am I not enlightened?
Well, according to the preaching of Buddha, animals are in the animal realm, so we know that they are not enlightened. If they are enlightened,
they are not doing anything else. Okay. Now, knowing that, repeating that fact to me, B, does that give you, what does that do for you? Does that make you happier? Does that make you more capable of being compassionate? Or is that just something else that we understand intellectually? There's so much we can know intellectually. And in Buddhism, as you know, it is endless, the type of intellectual understanding that we can develop. But that doesn't liberate us from our... Only this liberates us.
So is the knowledge that the animal realm is part of the sixth realm that the Buddha described, is intellectual knowledge not to be appreciated, that is a rejection of the Buddha's teaching.
You know, the Buddha taught...
We are caught up in words.
The Buddha taught this. The Buddha said, I teach only... The Buddha said, the Buddha said, I teach only one thing, the cessation of suffering. The Buddha did not come into this world to teach... What animals are up to. He said, obviously, the human realm has a great benefit that the other five realms do not have. And that is, it has aspects of all other five realms. Animal realm.
And the Buddha did not tell everybody to just sit under the Bodhi tree to talk.
But the Zen.
Before,
right. And this, and the Zen tradition is one of them. The Zen tradition is one of them.
And even within the Zen tradition, there are obviously a lot of work, because a lot of letters and poems and whatever has been written.
Right, but they're all pointing, they're all fingers pointing at the moon.
Yes.
And we want to get to the moon.
Because at this point, as a human being, that is what we are capable of, is fingers. The sole form that we...
Is that what you heard here today? Is that what you heard here today, that we're only capable of the finger? No, we are capable of...
For one small clarification.
Right, and that is what?
That all we need to do is to empty our mind. Mm-hmm. Why are animals not enlightened?
Because we're... Enlightenment means what?
What I heard today, that's for your information.
Yes.
Is that what you have been teaching and what my teacher has been teaching mm-hmm. to be very similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's being described in different mind view words.
Right. Good.
The concept.
Good.
And maybe the sequences of how things are being done.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I listen with wisdom,
mm-hmm.
with deep listening,
uh-huh.
and to try to listen beyond the words.
Good.
But there is this one small clarification I'm asking.
Yes.
That if all we need to do is empty our conceptual mind, then why are animals not enlightened? Because animals don't think conceptually.
Again.
Maybe they do. So how does the Zen master explain that, if ever a student asks him?
Well, what the Zen master would say, he said, if you're a human being, right, you talk like this. If you're an enlightened dog, you talk like this. Woof, 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 woof. There's no difference in that. Okay. When you are empty of self and other, you are totally true with your dog nature. There's a great koan. The first koan in Zen is called, does the dog have a Buddha nature? Maybe you know that koan. And that points directly to what you're asking. Does the dog have a Buddha nature? So it's not just you who thought about that. It is the first koan in the Mumon Kan. Does the dog have a Buddha nature? Right? So this is, but you know what? When you go before your Zen master, you can talk the endless time and he'll just ring the bell and throw you out. He won't accept an answer other than that you understand it from the inside. Does the dog have a Buddha nature? It's a good question. Does a dog have a Buddha nature? Does a human being have a Buddha nature?
So is the etiquette of the Zen hall, is that of the teacher teaching of the student
to practice? No, the student goes home and practices. Listening gets us nowhere. Listening is just the beginning. As the Buddha said, as you know, well know. Hear the teaching, reflect on the teaching, and then practice.
We have been listening for the past 30 or 45 minutes.
Mm, it's actually been almost an hour and a half.
Yeah. Okay. So we've done some sitting, and we've done some listening.
Mm-hmm.
We've done some reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
So
now it's time to sit empty.
Yeah.
Good. Good. Good Zen. When hungry, eat. Good. So, you must abandon your worldly mentality and sit quietly with a silent mind. Forget entangling causes and investigate with your whole being. So please, let's practice the rest of the day this way. In eating, in resting, in looking, tasting, smelling, whatever you're doing, right? Do it without any entanglement. And again, investigate deeply means what? There's really a very simple answer to that. When you're eating, you look deeply into, what is it that's eating? If you think that you're eating, look into that. If you think there's somebody walking, look into that. Investigate the nature of your experience. Good. So thank you, Master, great Master, eh? Beautiful, beautiful teaching today. Make enlightenment your standard.